Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. Today I have a very, very interesting personality, someone who spent a lot of time in the corporate world and is now devoting a lot of time giving back to society. Vivek Gore, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashutosh.
Vivek is a BCom. He's an MBA from Faculty of Management Studies. He's been to the OPM program at Harvard. He's worked for GE Capital, Genpact, AWorks, Empire Aviation. He's board member in several companies, and he's the founder of Heart to Heart Foundation. Vivek, talk to us a little bit about your early career, some of the things that you've done before we move on to the second part of the interview.
So most of my career was with General Electric, or GE Capital as it was more popularly known in India. Mm-hmm. And then that company morphed into what is today called Genpact. And the other major part of my career was with my own business, AirWorks India. Prior to joining Genpact and GE Capital in 1996, mm-hmm. I spent a few years with the Tata Group and with a small leasing company called First Leasing Company of India. But those were the formative years of my career.
So interesting you talk of First Leasing, because must have been the same time when I was with ITC and I founded Classic Leasing.
Okay. I was well aware of Classic Leasing, so it's a small world.
Yes.
And I joined First Leasing because in 85, leasing was a sunrise industry, right, as you formed Classic and ITC wanted to get into it. But sales tax laws changed and it made it very unattractive. And First Leasing was a pioneer in that business. And I said, this sounds like a good combination. Mm-hmm. And like all young MBAs, he was offering the highest salary out of the MBA school. Correct. And, you know, we all fall for that one. But I switched to Tata's very shortly thereafter in a company that was at that time called Tata Finance. Okay. And it went through various iterations in later years and is part of Tata Capital today. Mm-hmm. I was very keen to join General Electric.
Okay.
Having read about Jack Welch, and now I'm talking of the late 80s, early 90s, yeah, when he was an iconic personality. I guess he still is.
He still is.
Though General Electric isn't half the company today that it used to be 25 years back. Yeah. And I worked on GE for about 3 years to get a job. Mm. And I got three different jobs in GE Capital. And each time, as soon as it was time for me to get the appointment letter, their plans on India would change.
Okay.
So I think out of sort of exasperation, they finally did give me a job as a treasurer working under Pramod Bhasin. Mm-hmm. And then I later became CFO of GE Capital.
Okay.
And served in that role for 8 years. Mm-hmm. I think the most exciting part of that tenure was working with Pramod to carve out GE Capital International Services.
Correct.
From GE, converting it into an independent company, selling it to private equity, and then later taking it public on New York Stock Exchange, listing it for over $3 billion. That was a very, very rich learning experience.
That must have been fascinating, but I'm going to call you once some other time to come and talk about the entire exercise, if
yes,
you're permitted to do that.
Yes, why not? There's a lot in the public domain which I could share.
Okay.
It was certainly, it was the largest private equity transaction of its time.
Correct.
Now we are talking of 0304.
Yes.
And it was Pramod's vision that Jekis should be carved out, made into Genpact, grown as a separate company. It was his way of contributing back to his country. And it took quite a while for the management at GE in the US to grasp this.
Correct.
And accept it. But him as CEO and me as CFO kept hatching plans, kept making presentations, and we finally got our approval from them.
Terrific.
After a while.
Terrific, terrific. So you spent how many years in the corporate sector?
34. And or actually 33.
Okay.
Before I shifted to philanthropy.
Okay. And so my question is that after such a successful corporate career, mm, and you had quite a long runway ahead of you. Why did you decide to give up the corporate world and turn to philanthropy?
So the desire to spend the sort of latter 20 years of my active life working with philanthropic organizations or creating my own philanthropic organizations was something that was on my mind from the time I was a teenager. So, in fact, the...
You're clearly a very enlightened individual very early in life.
My wife might have a different view on that, but this was definitely on my mind in a very serious way. And but, you know, we all have desire for ambition, status, 2 ounces of publicity, a little bit of money. And I was no different. So I pursued a corporate career. I would not say I achieved everything I wanted or I achieved the pinnacle that I was aiming for. But at some point, I got to a stage where I said, the next, you know, tranche of money I earn, its sort of utility value from a spiritual, emotional, mental point of view is less, getting less and less. So maybe it is now time to switch gears. I actually thought I'd switch gears at 65. You know, that would have been a more normal time. But various factors, the opportunity to move came in 2018. And I decided to exit my business, which was Airworks India, and switch gears full time to philanthropy. It was not an easy decision. I guess such decisions of moving from to the vanasprastha ashram stage of life are never easy. But at, I just said, this is as good a time. Let's go for it.
That's fantastic. More power to you. So let's talk about, you know, your Heart to Heart Foundation, which you said you founded. Tell us a little bit about what you do in this foundation.
Yeah. So first, let me tell you the problem the foundation addresses.
Okay.
India has one of the highest infant mortality and child mortality rates in the world.
Correct.
For multiple reasons.
Yes.
One of the single largest causes is that the expectant mother is malnutrition during her pregnancy. And in most cases, even prior to that, as a young girl or lady. And hence, the fetus is born with a defective heart.
Oh, I see.
So India has, you know, depending on government studies, we read about 300,000 children born with a defective heart each year. Roughly 100,000 die in the first year. And a substantial number die in the first 3 years. Now, all this primarily due to malnutrition of the mother.
And is there empirical data available which says that malnutrition could result in heart?
There are some researches on that. This is a disease of the poor. So it is not something that happens in common to, say, your grandchild or my grandchild tomorrow. Because we belong to a different segment of society.
Absolutely.
And therefore, this has been researched very little.
Okay.
So cancer gets researched a lot because the disease that affects the rich also.
True.
Or
I'm with you completely.
Heart surgery, it affects the rich.
I'm completely on board with you because I served for 8 years on the board of Gavi, which is the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, which was set up for to meet the fourth millennium development goal of the UN, which was for women and child health. So I'm completely in agreement with you. But coming back to your initiative.
So we, two friends of mine and I, inspired by a gentleman called C. Srinivas, and I'll come to him in a minute, set up this foundation with the express purpose of funding surgeries, so pediatric heart surgeries, for babies of poor families born with this heart defect. Now, heart defect can be of many kinds, hole in the heart, valve not working, valve fitted incorrectly, whatever. I'm not a doctor.
Sure.
But the cost of the surgery varies. In a missionary or a charitable, semi-charitable hospital, the cost is between 85,000 to 4 lakhs. The average is between 1,50,000, give or take 10,000.
Sure.
So we said, let's set this up, raise money from high net worth individuals, corporate CSR, and try and see if we can fund a few individuals each month. At this point in time, we are supporting or sponsoring 30 to 40 children each month.
Wow.
We have zoned in on a chain of hospitals called Sai Sanjeevani, which Srinivas set up. Srinivas is roughly your age.
Okay.
He is, in my opinion, a living version of Mother Teresa.
Okay.
Very compassionate, very spiritual, completely detached person, but obviously a great manager and brilliantly efficient, because these three hospitals he has set up exclusively for pediatric work, which specialize in these heart surgeries. Mm-hmm. They do about 300 to 400 a month, and they do it free of cost.
Wow. You must introduce him to me to call him on the
show. I will introduce him. He may not choose to come, but I will definitely introduce him.
Okay.
And so we do all our surgeries at his three hospitals. Why? One is we found quality very good.
Mm-hmm.
Quality as I could judge, but one of my co-founders is a oncologist, so he can see it from a doctor's point of view. The other one is an entrepreneur making medical, inventing new medical gadgets, so he understands medicine. The second is compassion. Compassion for the patient.
Correct.
If you go to a large hospital, any of these commercial hospitals, the poor patient who comes there gets treated like dirt.
Mm.
A, he's poor, he's lost, he's already terrified, he can't afford to pay, he gets tossed around from one place to the other.
Mm.
Patients are not treated with dignity and compassion. But here I found that the patients were being treated with so much dignity and compassion that I think some of them didn't want to go back.
Wonderful.
And so I said, okay, we're going to use them. We did a costing on what each type of surgery is, arrived at some broad parameters, and patients go directly there and they say, can you fund it? Some patients come to Heart Foundation and we direct them to the hospital.
So how do the patients, how does, let's say, a young mother who is malnutritioned, first realize that her child is in danger, unborn child, and once the child is born, how does she determine that there is a congenital heart issue and then reach out to you?
Very, very good question. And so we are going to now talk of the poorest one third of the country.
Correct.
There are two, three routes that happen. At the grassroots level, through the ASHA workers or the Anganwadi workers, some minimum maternal postnatal checks do happen.
Okay.
If the heart problem is very serious, it does get detected that there is some problem.
Okay.
Many of these poor people would also be visiting the government clinics and hospitals. They would be visiting, some local doctor, because they start noticing that it's a blue baby, or the baby is not responding the way a one-month or a two-month-old should. And in some cases, they don't catch it till the child is close to a year old. And also the sort of poor in India, because the people in the 20th to 40th percentile are not as poor as when you and I were children. So some access to some private doctor, most of them have.
Okay.
However, after that, many of them get spun into a web of expenditure in these private clinics. Or the government hospitals say we can't perform because we don't have the skill or capability. The private doctors, some of them, take them on for a jolly ride. So we often find that they have completely exhausted all their economic resources in the treatment of that child by the time they finally reached out to us. Many of them are pretty much broke at that stage. So that's really how, and I guess there is a segment who never discover because the baby died in 3 months in any case.
That's very unfortunate. Yeah. So, you know, since we are on television and we're talking about all the good work you're doing, let's make a little pitch for Heart to Heart to all the people. And if someone wants to become a donor, how do they reach out?
So you could go to our website, www.h2h.foundation. There's a link on which you could make a payment.
Okay.
My phone number and email ID is there.
Okay.
You can always reach out to me in case you wish to give a check or a wire transfer instead of that typical credit card payment.
Great.
And we will be very happy to accept your donations.
Good. Thank you. So, I mean, you know, I'm sure this message will go out to a lot of people. Because you're doing such an amazing work. But let's move to the second part of your work that you are doing. And you spoke about rural shores as an investor, where you're again talking about skilling and employment of rural youth. So once again, here is Vivek Gaur who is giving back to children and who's giving back to rural youth. First question, tell us a little bit about rural shores. And the next question is, what is it that is driving you to keep doing so much?
I'm not sure I'm doing so much, but yeah, it does sound good. So see, Heart to Heart is about giving a person food to solve his hunger for the day.
Correct.
Rural Shores is about teaching him how to fish. So, the credit for Rural Shores goes to a friend of mine, Murli Vulaganti, currently based in the US, but he spends time equally between India and US, who came up with this concept about 15 years back that mini BPO centers should be set up in the villages.
Okay.
Very small centers. 50 employee, 100 employee centers, doing work in regional languages, like call center work in regional languages, for the big companies in the big cities.
Okay.
And those youth should be from that village and neighboring villages so that they get employment in their locality. They are not forced to migrate to large cities and live in slums. Or, you know, they go through all kinds of stresses.
And these BPOs, are they part of some large organizations? Or are they standalone BPOs?
No, these are...
call centers.
So these call centers are all Rural Shores call centers.
Okay.
Rural Shores is the BPO.
I see. Okay.
And we recruit people, we train them, we employ them. And most stay with us for 2-3 years. Because in that village... Now, by village, I mean village. I'm not saying tier 4 town. So, it would be a village where the only way to reach is by catching a state road transport bus and go jostling down for 2 hours.
But the infrastructure that Rural Shores requires is available.
Now it is available.
Okay.
15 years ago, it was not. So, you'll be surprised to learn that roughly half of India's villages have fiber connectivity today. So that then enables a call center to get set up.
Okay.
The youth in the villages, I find, are, there's no shortage of intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
There's no shortage of cunning either. Mm-hmm. Both sides. It's not as if they're holy cows or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all enthusiastic to learn. For them, it's a great opportunity because the call center would typically be a pakka brick building. It may or may not be air-conditioned, but it will definitely be clean. There's a canteen, there's a proper toilet, there's a table tennis room, etc. And for that 21-year-old villager, this is a great job to have.
Wonderful. So, you know, Vivek, you've been a corporate professional, you've been an entrepreneur, you've been associated with Heart to Heart, you're associated with Rural Shores. Let me try and get some yarn from you for all our listeners. You know, a lot of them are startup entrepreneurs. Based on all the experience, what are some of the basic mistakes a startup entrepreneur makes?
A startup entrepreneur, and I have been a startup entrepreneur too. Airworks was attempt two. I had one earlier attempt which failed spectacularly. Is that every entrepreneur is convinced he or she has built the perfect mousetrap.
Correct.
And the world is just dying to buy my mousetrap.
Correct.
As a consequence, we block out signals from the environment which tell us that A, the world is not willing to buy a mousetrap, or the world needs a fly swatter and not a mousetrap, or this mousetrap is too expensive, or whatever. So the willingness to be open and say, hey, this idea is not going to work, I need to switch gears. Number one, most entrepreneurs in today's environment miss out on that. And I'm talking of people who often are first generation entrepreneurs. So unlike the traditional business communities of India, the highly capable Guptas, Agarwals, Bansals, where the entire family was in business for seven generations. So there's tribal knowledge to help you. Right? But a lot of startups today are first generation, first time entrepreneurs. Their father worked in a government job. Their mother was a school teacher. They don't have the benefit of this tribal background. The second is that the challenges that lie ahead of you are usually about 5 or 10 times greater than anything you think is the case. Anything you think is the case.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, the third is sometimes in some areas like e-commerce or IT or a few buzzword industries, we have too much capital chasing too few good deals. So it's possible to raise some initial capital without realizing that in the hubris and excitement that you've raised the capital, you have to find a way to one day give it back. So I worry about entrepreneurs that are always on a burn, not generating cash, not generating profit.
Correct.
And, one day the cows are going to come home and say, give my money back.
Yeah, I'm with you. Completely agree. So, a follow-up question on that, and this I'm asking you because of all the experience you have. You know, the Indian mindset of my parents, and now I as a parent, we basically have been telling our kids, and we were told that you have to win. Which, manifests itself in all of us trying to be right in front of the traffic light, and in every queue, we must be first.
Yes.
And it's a mindset because of our population. Nowhere are we taught the importance of understanding failure. And I'm trying to do a lot of research with a lot of people like you to say how important is it for our young people to understand that failure is not doomsday.
Yes.
What are your thoughts?
So, in my life personally, failure has been the best teacher. Very painful, very hurtful, very depressing, but in the long run, it is always the best teacher. Yeah. And you're right that our culture that we must always win, beta tumko first aana hi hai, sort of a thing, then pushes us to believe that happiness will only come from success. So in 2000, with a few friends, I set up a dot-com startup, the first generation dot-com startup.
So did I, and lost a lot of money.
Lost a lot of money,
yeah.
Got completely broke. And I left my job with General Electric to do this. My wife didn't know any better. So she said, yeah, maybe it will work out. And I was so exuberant. Again, the perfect mousetrap. I didn't even realize that one of the partners was making a complete Mickey of the rest of us. And we completely exploded. We didn't realize that we had come to the party too late. By January 2000, the party was winding down just when we were getting in.
Correct.
So I lost a lot of money. The company folded up. I didn't have a job. Two children. A EMI on our house to pay to HDFC. So my mother said, you better go back to GE and fall at their feet and get a job.
Correct.
Which is exactly what I did then. And GE was gracious enough to hire me back.
Yeah.
So also failures in you know, my tenure at Airworks, everything didn't go perfect. These all help you learn.
Correct.
Provided you're willing to sit back, be humble, introspect, and say, okay, stuff happened. But you know, I can start today and change the rest of my life.
I agree. Well said. Very well said. So a few questions for you personally now.
Definitely.
You know, tell me, what would you, you know, you have an amazing career and you're doing amazing work now. What would be the three adjectives that would define your strengths? And I know one you did mention, perseverance, because of the way you kept for 3 years after GE. But I'm sure there are many others.
Yes, perseverance would be one, or doggedness. I think the my greatest strength is detachment.
Okay.
So our wives know us best. So this morning I asked her, this question is going to come, what should I say? And she came up with detachment.
Okay.
Ups and downs come. Tragedies happen in life. Sometimes great success also comes, which can go up here and make you a little lightheaded. But I think what has served me well all through is detachment. Theek hai. This will also move on.
This
fantastic. Got a double promotion. Very good. No big deal. You haven't become chairman of Unilever. So relax and enjoy it. Similarly, failure has happened, like happened in my first .com, which was completely devastating. But 1 week later, I got a job in GE. So at least the monthly bills could be paid. So, detachment from helps me stand aside and say, okay, so what happened? And not feel too much anger, resentment, nurturing, disappointment, or anything of the kind.
Let's
keep. Detachment doesn't mean laziness or lack of interest.
Yeah. Also, not looking back and regretting. Why
not
did
regretting
I do this?
Too much? Yeah. We all are human. There's always some look back. But as I said, my favorite phase is you can start from today and change the rest of your life.
So, Vivek, this gives me an interesting segue into my next question. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been speaking of failures and learning. And we've all had our fair share of learnings. And a lot of people who view our discussions. Young people who somehow feel that successful people like you have not had failures. And that's why I ask this question from all my guests. What have been some of your learnings from your failures?
One is not to underestimate myself. And all of us are capable of applying our minds, common sense, and a huge amount of effort to overcome a situation. And the situation could be a business situation. It could be issues with colleagues or bosses or customers. It could be legal problems that have fallen on you. It could be anything. It could be a, you know, near fatal illness of a child. It can be many things. But don't underestimate yourself. Second is, don't underestimate the challenge. I often come across people, I'm not saying it's an issue of young people today, it was an issue of young people 50 years ago also, who say, main to ye kar lunga, no problem, I'll just crack the exam. And I say, oh man, I mean, either you're Einstein or you've underestimated the situation. So they sort of walk in or they need to bluff themselves that this is easy. And maybe 1 year later, they wonder what happened and don't introspect enough. And I find this happening with, I often find this happening with people who are younger in age. Maybe it happens with older people too. But underestimating the challenge that lies ahead and what resources you will have to put to overcome them. We get too caught up with our own dream sequence of what that means, rather than what lies under the lake over there.
Very true. Very well said. So I only have two more questions here for you. Next question is, do you have any regrets?
So one regret I have is, I have failed to be able to reduce my weight despite spending 25 years trying. Okay. I think there is no diet in this world I have not attempted, or no combination of diet, exercise, pill, standing on your head that I have not tried. And I do realize that to be able to be effective and active and healthy for the next 20 years, from 57 to 77, I need to find a way to reduce my weight.
Okay, and I'm sure you'll find something.
That has beaten me completely.
Wonderful. And my last question to you now is, a lot of young people starting out like you and I did, I'm older than you, many, many years ago, all starry-eyed, corporate careers, entrepreneurs. As you look back at life, what are some of your learnings that you want to share with them?
So one is, we have too much of the media. It was there in our time, and it is infinitely more today, telling us what we need to be happy. And I would call it a disease. The disease of social media and the dopamine hits of those likes are deciding a lot for our young people. And our young people are very intelligent, very capable. They are growing into an India which is becoming an economic powerhouse. So they have all the best opportunities that were not there 50 years ago. And they are getting trapped in what means happiness, what means success, what should I be doing or not doing or wearing. You know, so people sort of constantly clicking their photos and placing it on Facebook or wherever is an indication of a desperation for reassurance all the time. And if you have to be successful in life, either materially or spiritually, Facebook and Instagram cannot be your measure of who you are.
Very well said.
And you cannot... I worry that a lot of young people start believing their own newspaper stories.
Correct.
That they put up on Facebook.
You get carried away by your own hype.
You get carried away by your own hype. And it's taking away so much energy which you could otherwise have put into your career or skill development or improving your relationship with your spouse and parents. That would be, this is a new phenomena that was not there 20 years
ago. Right. So Vivek, thank you very much. I think
pleasure.
Incredible words of wisdom.
Thank you so much.
And good luck to everything that you are doing.
Yes.
And more power.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for the Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.